Hello, I'm Richard Penson, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's podcast entitled Planning Ahead, Maintenance Therapy in Endometrial Cancer. Today's program is supported by a joint educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck Sharp and Dohme Corp, and a subsidiary of Merck & Co. Incorporated. Again, I'm Richard Penson, a physician at Mass General Brigham and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. I'm also one of the IRB chairs at the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center in Boston. I would like to welcome my esteemed colleague, Dr. Nicoletta Colombo from the European Institute of Oncology, where she is associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Milan, Bicocca in Italy. Welcome, Nicoletta.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Before we begin, I'd like to just repeat our learning objective, which is to assess the role of maintenance therapy in the treatment of endometrial cancer with a real focus on immunotherapy. So, Nicoletta, let's start with a quick review of the relevant data before we discuss the application of this data in the care of women with endometrial cancer. 2023 was really the year that immunotherapy arrived in endometrial cancer. And now, not just pembrolizumab, but durvalumab, dostarlimab, and atezolizumab. How do you see these new data?
Yes, indeed. This year was incredible. I mean, we have four randomized trials, with a total of 661 patients with the DMMR. And 1,951 patients in the pMMR population. So a total of 2,600 patients, including in these four trials. And they all show very consistent results, at least for the dMMR population, a little bit more controversial, as we may discuss later, regarding the pMMR population. So let me just summarize very briefly the data. First of all, the NRG study GY018, which was a large randomized study, which included two separate populations. That's very important because this is different from the other studies. So this study included a DMMR population and a pMMR population, and the analysis was done and was pre-specified for these two different populations. And the question was the addition of pembrolizumab to standard of care chemotherapy for histologically confirmed recurrent or advanced endometrial cancer. Patients were receiving standard of care chemotherapy with placebo or with pembrolizumab, which was then continued for up to 14 cycles, Q6 weeks. And the primary endpoint, and this is also very important, the study was progression-free survival. And the secondary endpoints were overall survival, and of course, response rate, duration of response, quality of life, and so on. So this study was very important because it showed an incredible benefit in the DMMR population. If we want to start with the DMMR population, incredible benefit in progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.30 in favor of pembrolizumab compared to placebo. But also is very important because in this study had the power to analyze the results in the proficient population, in the pMMR population. And in this population, the benefit was there with the addition of pembrolizumab and maintenance with pembrolizumab with a hazard ratio of 0.54. So this was also statistically significant. We have a median progression-free survival in this population of 13 months compared to 8 months in the placebo group. They also showed that the benefit was very consistent across different pre-specified subgroups if we look at the DMMR population, but also in the pMMR population, the benefit was there. They also show an improvement in response rate and duration of response in the DMMR and the pMMR population. So the primary endpoint was met, the progression-free survival, but also if we look at secondary endpoints, an improvement in overall response rate and duration of response. Very importantly, I think very recently, they also showed that the improvement in progression-free survival was seen in the also DMMR methylated population. So the question was, among these DMMR tumors, how many of these were mutated or how many were methylated? And they look at the methylated population, and which is, of course, the majority of patients, and they show that the benefit is there. So it's not only for mutated DMMR, but also for methylated DMMR. In terms of side effects, of course, you can see a little bit more side effects in the maintenance phase, but overall the treatment is extremely well tolerated. So this study is unique because, again, provided information not only on the DMMR population, but also on the PMMR population. The follow-up time is a little bit short, but as I said, the main endpoint was progression-free survival and no overall survival because the crossover was allowed to these patients. Now, the other trials, very briefly, one is the RUBY trial, which was presented and published at the same time. The design was, again, chemo plus placebo or dostarlimab, followed by dostarlimab for 3 years. And this study was different because there was no pre-specified analysis of the PMMR population, but the analysis was done on the DMMR population first and then on the overall population, on the intention to treat population. And here the endpoint was progression-free survival, but also overall survival. So these are the main differences. And the trial showed an incredible advantage, very similar for the DMMR population and for the overall population, and also a trend in overall survival improvement for the intention to treat population. And very recently, a press release announced that this overall survival data became statistically significant. We haven't seen the data yet, they announced that overall survival is now also positive. So that's very important information. They recently also looked at the subgroup, molecular subgroup analysis, and they show some very interesting, I think it's just a hypothesis generating, but besides the DMMR population, the greatest effect was seen in the P53 mutated patients. So it looks like in the P53, the addition of the dostarlimab may provide a greater benefit compared to other subgroups. But again, this, I think, needs confirmation in a more prospective way.
Just to interrupt you, I think if you said, what is the most exciting thing, and I might ask you to comment, what are you most excited about seeing in 2024? I think those subsets in GY018 is what I'd really like. That sort of for scientists sort of is very exciting. Can I ask you to get a bit more granular about those two different studies? So for example, the RUBY study allowed the carcinosarcomas in a specific cohort, and they were different. But looking at the DMMR group, the median progression-free survival was amazingly similar, 7.7, 7.6 between the two groups. And they clearly did fabulously, not reached in terms of progression-free survival and highly statistically significant, 70% better when you get immunotherapy. In the PMMR group, it was a bit longer in the GY018 with pembrolizumab, 8.7 versus 7.9. It's not much different, but they did quite a lot better. RUBY 9.9 months and 13.1 months with pembrolizumab in GY018. When you think about these trials, do you think about them as essentially exactly the same PD-1 targeting agents, and you've now four agents that we're excited about? Are you the sort of clinical scientist who really gets in the weeds with the fine print?
I think the results are very consistent in the DMMR population, but I can see differences also if we look at the other two trials in the PMMR population for sure. I think that there are differences across these studies. First of all, the population included may be a little bit different. I'm surprised, for instance, I look at the characteristics in the ENERGY study, I was expecting a lot of endometrioid grade 3 tumor because this was advanced and recurrent, but indeed there is quite a lot of grade 1 and 2, which is kind of surprising to me, and this is not the case for the other studies. I don't know why, but this
I think that reflects American practice. So in David Miller's original paclitaxel carboplatin beats TAC chemotherapy study, a third of the patients were alive at 5 years. And it sort of reminds you that where you draw your population from, especially if it's a bit inhomogeneous, it really changes what you're looking at. And you do have to be careful.
Yeah, in fact, that's something that I was looking at the data and I picked up this difference in terms of again, the GR018 study had a specifically endpoint in the PMMR population, and included more patients in this group, more than 200 patients. On the RUBY trial, there were much less, 120 patients. And the study design was not really in terms of looking specifically at the results in the PMMR population. So this is just a secondary analysis that we are doing. The trend is there, however, I must say that, you can see definitely a trend. For sure, the efficacy is absolutely great in the DMMR population. I'm personally a little bit less convinced at the PMMR. I mean, there is something there for sure. I think we should do a little bit better in this population. Probably new targets are coming now, and we should look at these new targets in this non-DMMR population and try to improve much more our results. But of course, in the absence of other opportunity, I think this provides evidence that you may still improve at least progression-free survival in this population. It's a little bit different, I think, if you look at overall survival. As I said, the ENERGY study did not have overall survival as primary endpoint, so it's difficult to say what's happening in this population because of the high crossover, which is happening, I think, in the United States. So it was difficult to look at the overall survival. But in Europe, we pay attention to overall survival much more, I think, compared to US.
Yeah, maybe this is a good moment to talk a bit about that. So, I have to give homage to the Food and Drug Administration, because I think that shift to accelerated approval and the use of surrogate endpoints has transformed oncology care, because drugs that clearly are effective have a reachable standard. Overall survival, all too often, is it's going to take sort of epidemiologic data 20 years later to know if we really impacted overall survival. But in Europe, the bar is higher. And maybe for good reason. That is the hard endpoint. What is the overall survival? Tell me about your philosophy as an investigator.
I must say that until recently, I also was not so much convinced that we needed overall survival, because overall survival was so difficult to reach as an endpoint. Very, very few trials in ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, endometrial cancer were able to demonstrate any improvement overall survival. But look, more recently, even in ovarian cancer, we now have so, I think, potent drugs that you can see the effect on overall survival. And it's changing. I mean, in ovarian cancer frontline, whenever we were able to see an improvement in overall survival, but now we have trials showing an improvement in overall survival, even in ovarian cancer. And the same is here, I think. Look at cervical cancer. We have now trials demonstrating. Look at endometrial cancer, even in second line with pembrolizumab lenvatinib compared to standard of care, you see improvement in overall survival. So I think it's a little bit different. I'm not sure that, I mean, I would like to improve the survival.
Yeah. 25 years ago, when I came to the US from the UK, my sort of pitch to patients was, we're expanding options. now we are impacting survival, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
So you had the privilege of leading the ATTEND study as principal investigator. And so that was one of two high impact positive trials, that and DUO-E. So tell us about the expanding options for patients with respect to immunotherapy in endometrial cancer.
Okay. So as I said, ATTEND was another trial very similar to RUBY, but using a different immunotherapy. And the main difference, we are using here an anti-PD-L1 instead of anti-PD-1. Again, I think our study demonstrated a similar efficacy in the dMMR population, but we see much less efficacy in the pMMR population compared to, for instance, the NRG study. And also, there was something which is still intriguing to me, and we are analyzing. We have 20% of patients from Asia in the ATTEND trial, which was not the case in the other studies, but it was in the DUO-E. And we see a kind of different response.
Sorry to jump in, but I have a theory. So one of my theories is that what's been interesting is maybe there's more endometriosis in that group, and like gastric cancer is different in Asia. I wonder whether that's part of it, because you showed no impact for ARID1A in your data set. I loved the data sets from ATTEND. I thought they were really interesting. And I'm going to ask you about PD-L1 in a moment. But do you have a theory about why the Asian patients got less benefit?
No, really. We looked very carefully at all the clinical characteristics. Of course, the Asian patients are a little bit different. For instance, they receive much more chemotherapy and less radiotherapy, as a prior treatment. They are younger, thinner, and the BMI, of course, is much lower in this population. But we could not find a specific reason for the difference. Now we are performing molecular analysis, and we are looking specifically also in the Asian population to see if there are differences there, because it's very intriguing, actually. And this is not for the dMMR, but it's more for the pMMR population, where we see really less efficacy in the Asian population compared to the. And if you look at the DUO-E data, you kind of see a similar trend. If you look at the forest plot for the DUO-E, you see quite a similar effect there. So is something that we should really try to explain.
So my comment about the PD-L1 was just going to be that bizarrely, the PD-L1 positive patients seem to do worse in the dMMR group. And I think that's probably just that dMMR is such a powerful dictator of the outcome. But because it's more interesting to talk about DUO-E in some ways, that was a high impact study. I definitely come from the camp that says you've got to make the microenvironment better with antiandrogenics. But to see a PARP inhibitor give such great outcomes. Tell us about DUO-E.
Yeah. So DUO-E is again different compared to the others, because here we are looking not only at the addition of durvalumab, so anti-PD-L1, but also at the addition of durvalumab and olaparib. So we have the PARP inhibitor here. And the patients were not selected actually for BRCA mutation or homologous recombination deficiency. And the study design was to compare two different experimental arms with a control arm. So the durvalumab arm given together and as a maintenance until progression, and that's another difference. And the other experimental arm was durvalumab plus olaparib. And then, of course, the control arm. The study was very interesting, because if you look at the overall population in intention to treat population, both experimental arms showed an improvement in progression-free survival, which was the main endpoint, compared to the control arm. And again, it's not possible to compare the two experimental arms each other, because the study design was actually to compare each of these experiment arms with the control. So unfortunately, there is no power to compare the two experimental arms. Anyhow, it was clear that the benefit was there for durvalumab, also for durvalumab plus olaparib. And if we look more specifically in the DMMR and PMMR population, as you said, it looks like the two experimental arms are very, very close to each other, but much better than the control. On the other hand, if you look at the proficient population, then it looks like the Durva plus olaparib arm perform a little bit better compared to Durva alone. But again, you know, there is no power to detect any difference there. But as you said, we have this PD-L1 data, which are extremely interesting because overall, patients with PD-L1 positive tumor had a greater benefit, I would say, both from durvalumab and the combination of durvalumab and olaparib, but particularly from the combination of durvalumab and olaparib. So here you see really a great advantage for this combination compared to the control arm. But yeah, if you look at the PD-L1 negative, the three curves are absolutely superimposed. So it looks like there is no benefit in the PD-L1 negative population. I want to say that even in the ATTEND trial, if we look at the overall population, we see a possible better outcome in patients with PD-L1 positive tumor compared to the other. So it's something, again, very similar. And also here, there was 30% of Asians in the DUO-E. And we had 20% in the ATTEND, while in the other two trials, there were no Asians at all. Mm. So there are absolutely differences, yeah, to explore.
Yeah. Some brief questions, and we're into our last 5 minutes. When is selinexor arriving in Europe, do you think?
Okay, we are starting now, right now, the trial. You know, we are starting the phase three. Because this trial, we need confirmation, of course, from the subgroup analysis of the previous trial. So now we are starting a phase three to confirm the efficacy in the P53 wild type population. And so hopefully the phase three will be positive and then we will be able to use. But this, I think, is very important because in the non-DMMR population, we need to personalize the treatment much more. Mm. And one possibility is to look at the P53 wild type and to use selinexor. Then, of course, as you know, we have the HER2 positive tumor with a very good new opportunity. We have the hormone positive with another opportunity. So I think in this population, we need to differentiate our treatment and to look more specifically according to the targets that we have available in this population. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So going back, so I completely hear you. Those subsets, I think, are one of the most exciting things for me. But going back to the deficient mismatch repair, the DMMR patients, so it's quite impressive that at about 1 year, the curves really flatten. So in your practice, clinical practice outside of clinical trials, do you use 1 year, 2 years, indefinite therapy?
Oh, yeah, that's a $1 million question, I think. As you know, in the trial, there was a different duration because with the Pembro was 2 years, with the Lostalimab was 3 years. In the DUO-E and ATTEND, we went on until progression. But you are right. I mean, there is a clear, that's the most exciting aspect. Yeah. Of this treatment, the flattening of the curves after 1 year, 1 year and a half, I would say. So, but the question is, it will be like that even if we stop the treatment or not. So we don't know, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there is, I think probably 2 years should be enough.
The standard, yeah. So it's interesting. The title of this podcast is, the new immunotherapy agents, but really the focus of maintenance therapy. So I love the concept of it being maintenance. We are intervening as a strategy to ensure the either the best chance of cure or the best overall survival. So I just want to run a case by you, Professor. So this is a lovely lady. I literally met her last week, a 70-year-old with recurrent deficient mismatch repair endometrial cancer. She had surgery in 2018 and had sentinel lymph nodes that were negative. So she had definitive surgery, laparoscopic, and was done. And then now, 5 years later, she's being worked up for cardiovascular disease, not unusual in this patient population. And she's incidentally found on scan to have a 6-centimeter omental met, which turns out to be oligometastatic, an omental metastasis and a small other peritoneal metastasis, really round. It feels like this lady's immune system is doing something. And so with the new data, I waggy-tailed and excited came to her with, you know, the whole standard of care has changed. And she pushed me back to talking about single agent pembrolizumab and whether she had as good a chance of being cured in a few years' time if she had, the treatment, 3 cycles, interval cytoreductive surgery, which should be fine after her surgery. After a valve and coronary artery surgery. And so she really doesn't want to lose her hair with chemotherapy. And I was beating the standard of care, paclitaxel carboplatin pembrolizumab. And she was saying, well, pembrolizumab sounds awesome. How would you frame that decision for patients? Chemotherapy naive, in the pembrolizumab study, the Keynote study, everybody had prior treatment. So sort of can't exactly compare them. But when you talk to a 70-year-old woman in a bed in the hospital, what do you say?
I think she's right. I mean, of course, as you know, there are 2 trials ongoing right now comparing in frontline immunotherapy alone versus chemotherapy, which is, by the way, the wrong control arm right now, because the standard of care now is chemo plus immunotherapy. But anyhow, so there are already 2 ongoing trials looking at pembro alone or dostarlimab alone in frontline in previously untreated patients. So I think if the patient refuses chemo, it would be perfectly fine to use immunotherapy alone. I mean, looking at the results that we had with pembro alone and also with other immunotherapy, I think probably immunotherapy alone should be and could be enough for this population. You can still use chemotherapy after that, but I would try with pembro because my experience is that you can see dramatic response with pembrolizumab alone in this population. Completely, the tumor completely gone after a few cycles of pembrolizumab. So I would respect her idea of not going through chemotherapy if you can. I mean, if your system allows. In Italy, we have problems because, of course, it will be difficult to get the reimbursement of the drug because it's out of the indication. But if you can do that, I think I would consider.
You would favor it. Ah, interesting. Yeah, that's lovely. She would love to hear you say that. Good job. Yeah. So, unfortunately, it's time to wrap up our discussion. So, let me summarize what we've covered today. Exciting times. Drugs like pembrolizumab just transforming the standard of care. In March, 2 studies in the New England Journal of Medicine from the SGO presentations with dramatically better outcomes and now overall survival advantages. They're just very exciting. And some of the things like DuoE, for example, really trying to push the benefit to a greater number of participants by adding in new agents. And then a summary case in which we remind ourselves that for this group with the deficient mismatch repair, sometimes the magic, the wonder of activation of the immune system is sufficient really to transform how we approach patients with these new options. You can find additional information and resources at the CME Outfitters Oncology Hub with a number of excellent resources for clinicians and patients. To receive CME CE credit for today's program, complete the post-test evaluation, and you'll be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Remember, this is the third of a six-part podcast series on gynecologic cancers. Next month, I'll be joined by Dr. Katie Moore to discuss the role of maintenance therapy in the treatment of advanced ovarian cancer, and I hope you'll be able to join us. You can find additional podcasts in the series on the Oncology Hub at cmeoutfitters.com. But again, I want to thank you, Nicoletta. You are fabulous, and thank you for joining me for this very important discussion, and thank you to our audience for participating and for providing the best care for patients with endometrial cancer.
Thank you. Thank you for the great discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.